Somebody was mentioning yesterday that I watch the clock fairly well. But somebody told me that you used to get out, you know, before 11:30, before 7:30, before 8:30. Before 8:30 in the evening. Just wondered how many noticed what time you were dismissed this morning. It was before 11:30. Surely isn't that bad coming to church for an hour. I know you all have your Bible with you tonight, right? How about somebody looking up Micah 5:2 for me? I'd like for someone to read that after a while. Somebody else look up Luke chapter 2. A couple of verses in Luke 2 that I'd like to have read after a while. And then Psalm 98. Last six verses there. And whoever has their finger in Luke 2 will also take a look at an additional verse in that chapter. You know, we sing these Christmas songs, these Christmas hymns, and there's stories behind almost every hymn that we have. I don't know, maybe some of you have already read these stories and studied them a little bit. We're going to take three of them tonight and look at them. I'm watching the clock, so you don't have to. And if we run out of time, I can stop before we get to the end of the third one or something. The first one is one that we sang this evening, I believe. Did we sing Hark the Herald Angels Sing? I think we did. That's song number 446. First of all, though, who has Micah? Who wants to read Micah 5:2? Somebody, go ahead, Benjamin, or not Benjamin, Adam. Shoot, that's a bad one. That's the basis, the supporting verse that the author chose to use for this particular song. The author, if you look in your hymn book, you know that it's Charles Wesley. And he lived back in the 1700s, being born 1707 and died in 1788. The background of that song goes something like this. Hark the Herald Angels Sing is another of the more than 6,500 hymns from the pen of Charles Wesley that have enriched Christian hymnody. It is thought to have been written approximately 1 year after his dramatic Aldersgate conversion experience of 1738. This text, along with Jesus, Lover of My Soul, is generally considered to be one of Wesley's finest. According to John Julian, a noted hymnologist, this is one of the four most popular hymns in the English language. It certainly has become one of the classic Christmas carol hymns to the present time, sung thousands of times every year all around the world. The text first appeared in Hymns and Sacred Poems of 1739 with the first stanza beginning like this. Hark how all the welkin rings, glory to the King of Kings. Does that sound familiar? Really never heard of it, huh? Welkin is archaic for heavens and sky. So I guess that translation brings it down to what we know. Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. The text, then, was altered to its present form in George Whitefield's collection of 1753. In its original version, the text consisted of 10 four-line stanzas. I wish we had them all. Although there have been various alterations made on this text through the years, the present version is still basically the product of Charles Wesley. Like so many of Wesley's hymns, this text is really a condensed course in biblical doctrine in poetic form. Following the retelling of the angelic visit to the shepherds in the initial stanza, the succeeding verses teach such spiritual truths as the virgin birth, Christ's deity, the immortality of the soul, the second or new birth, and a concern for Christ-like living. As the late Eric Routley noted, a noted English hymnist, observes in his book, these Wesley hymns were composed in order that men and women might sing their way not only into experience but also into knowledge, that the cultured might have their culture baptized and the ignorant might be led into the truth by the gentle hand of melody and rhyme. That's why Charles Wesley's songs have so much weight to them. They had a distinct intent and value eternally. The tune, it's called Mendelssohn, was contributed by one of the master composers of the early 19th century, Felix Mendelssohn. He was born into a Jewish Christian home on February 3, 1809 in Hamburg, Germany, and died on November 4th of 1847. Mendelssohn was a highly acclaimed boy prodigy, making his first public appearance as a pianist at the age of 9. It's incredible, isn't it? Felix Mendelssohn was not only a noted performer and conductor, but also a prolific composer throughout his brief lifetime. His works included symphonies, chamber music, concertos, as well as much organ, piano, and vocal music. His most popular work still widely performed today is the oratorio The Elijah, first performed in England on August 26, 1846. Although other tunes have been tried with Wesley's text, the Mendelssohn has become the recognized music for this carol hymn. It is interesting to note briefly the history of our Christmas carol hymns. The word carol is derived from the word carola, which means a ring dance. Carols, then, now we're going to quit using Christmas carols, aren't we? Carols, then, have long been thought of as an early form of sacred folk music dating in time from the early Middle Ages. During this period, they seem to have been an integral part of the early mystery and miracle plays which were widely used by the medieval church for teaching its religious dogmas. The carols were sung during these plays as an intermezzo between the various scenes, much like the role of a modern-day orchestra between the scenes of a drama production. Then in 1627, the English Puritan Parliament abolished the celebration of Christmas and all other worldly festivals. During the remainder of the 17th century and well into the 18th century, there was a scarcity of these folk-like carol hymns in England. Charles Wesley's Hark the Herald Angels Sing represents one of the relatively few important carol hymns to have been written during this time. Imagine, a song that we have become so accustomed to was actually against the law, not allowed to be used. Now, our hymn book, song number 446, has, I think it's three verses, three stanzas. And a copy that I have here has four. The third stanza, or actually the second and the third stanzas in our hymn book, is quite a bit different from the one that is written here. Let me read to you the second verse. If you want to follow in your book there, it's 446. Christ by highest heaven adored, Christ the everlasting Lord. Late in time behold him come, offspring of a virgin's womb. The rest of that verse is the same. The third verse changes down, I guess the last half of the stanza is different, but I'll read the whole. Hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace, hail the Son of Righteousness, Light and life to all he brings, risen with healing in his wings. Here's where it differs. Mild he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. You see the doctrine that was being talked about. Verse number 4, come desire of nations, come, fix in us thy humble home. Rise the woman's conquering seed, bruise in us the serpent's head. Adam's likeness now efface, stamp thine image in its place. Second Adam from above, reinstate us in thy love. That was the work of the coming of the Christ, to do that. The second song I want to look at this evening is It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, song number 445, written by Edmund Sears. Luke chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Who wants to read that one for me? Hand goes up all over the place. Who wants to read it? Janae, go ahead. Hold your finger there. We're going to look at another verse later on. It came upon a midnight clear. The writer here says that no Christmas season would be complete without the singing of this beloved carol hymn. Since the text was first published in 1849, scarcely a hymnal has been printed in which it is not included. It was one of the first carol hymns ever written by an American writer. The author, Reverend Edmund Hamilton Sears, was born on April 6, 1810, in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. He received his theological training at the Harvard Divinity School, graduating in 1837. He spent most of the remaining years of his life pastoring small Unitarian churches at Wayland, Lancaster, Weston, and Weston, Massachusetts. Does that startle anybody? The author of this well-known and beloved Christmas hymn was written by a Unitarian preacher. Listen to what the author has to say about that. Many, no doubt, are surprised that a Unitarian could write such a fine text about the events surrounding Christ's nativity. It was often said, however, that Sears was more a Unitarian in name than by conviction, and that he actually believed and preached the deity of Christ from his pulpit. He wrote, "Although I was educated in the Unitarian denomination, I believe and preach the divinity of Christ." See, a Unitarian wouldn't have written a song like that had he been fully persuaded of the Unitarian doctrine, because Christ was a prophet, not deity. Reverend Sears authored only two hymn texts, each of them intended for the Christmas season. His first carol hymn, written while he was still a student in Harvard Divinity School, was entitled "Calm on the Listening Ear of Night." Though not as popular, this hymn is included in various hymnals today and is still frequently used. There is a close resemblance between this text and It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, written 15 years later. The first stanza of Reverend Sears' initial carol hymn goes like this. "Calm on the listening ear of night comes heaven's melodious strains, where wild Judea stretches forth her silver-mantled plains. Celestial choirs from courts above shed sacred glories there, and angels with their sparkling lyres," I guess that's lyres, not lyres, "and angels with their sparkling lyres make music in the air." Came Upon a Midnight Clear is generally considered to be one of the first hymn carols to emphasize the social implications of the angel's message, that of achieving peace and goodwill toward our fellow men in the midst of our social difficulty. The writing of this text occurred at a time in American history when there was much unrest. There was the foreboding of the tensions between the North and the South, which finally erupted a decade later in the Civil War. In New England, there was much social upheaval as a result of the Industrial Revolution there. It was also the time of the frantic 49er gold rush to California. This hymn text, then, addresses these concerns. It is for those who are, quote, beneath the crushing load, and urges us to listen once again to the singing of the angels. The final stanza is the great verse of hopeful optimism, the golden age. Quote, when peace shall over all the earth its ancient splendors fling, and the whole world gives back the song which now the angels sing. The tune for this carol hymn, Carol, was contributed by a rather well-known American musician of the 19th century, Richard Storrs Willis. Willis was born on February 10, 1819, in Boston, Massachusetts, and died on May 7, 1900, in Detroit, Michigan. Part of his musical training included 6 years of composition study in Germany, where he became an intimate friend of Felix Mendelssohn. So we just heard about him on the last song, didn't we? Who was greatly interested in his compositions. After Willis returned to the United States in 1848, he served as a music critic for New York Tribune and several other newspapers. Richard Willis's tune Carol has proven to be a worthy melodic vehicle for Edmund Sears' text as generations around the world continue to sing and enjoy this carol each Christmas season. Why don't we turn to that song and sing it, since we haven't sung it yet tonight? We still have time yet. 445. I think these verses are all the same to the ones that I have here, I hope. You sing out and ignore what I'm singing if it's not right. It came upon a midnight clear, that glorious song of old. Near the earth to touch their harps of gold. Besong the earth goodwill. The gracious King.
Prophet parts foretold. circling years comes round the age of gold, when peace shall over all the earth there's bling, and the whole world gives back the song which now the angels sing.
All right, moving on to the third and final song tonight. Luke 2:10, Janae. Joy is the keynote of the entire Advent season, especially for the Christian who realizes its spiritual significance. Isn't that right? Very God Himself invading this world and providing a means whereby sinful man might live eternally. This text is generally considered to be one of the most joyous Christmas hymns in existence. Not in the sense of merrymaking, but in the deep and solemn realization of what Christ's birth has meant to mankind. This Advent hymn is another of Watts' hymns from his well-known hymnal of 1719, Psalms of David imitated in the language of the New Testament. It was Isaac Watts' intent in writing this collection to give the Psalms a New Testament meaning and style. This he did in the 1719 collection by paraphrasing in Christian verse all of the 150 Psalms with the exception of 12, which he felt were unfit for this purpose. Joy to the World is a paraphrase of these verses taken from the last part of Psalm 98. Who's ready to read from Psalm 98, beginning at verse 4 to the end? Sister Etta. Psalm 98 is a song of rejoicing at the marvelous ways in which God has protected and restored His chosen people. The psalm anticipates the time when Jehovah will be the God of the whole earth and Israel's law will be accepted by all the nations. Watts, however, has given this verse a fresh interpretation, a New Testament expression of praise for the salvation that began when God became incarnate as the babe of Bethlehem and was destined to remove the curse of Adam's fall. Isaac Watts first titled his text, "The Messiah's Coming and Kingdom." Now a little bit about him as a child. Even as a boy, Isaac Watts displayed literary genius and an aptitude for study. At the age of 5, he was learning Latin. At 9, Greek. At 11, French. And at 13, Hebrew. It's hard enough to pronounce those words, let alone study them. In addition to his hymn writing, Watts became known as an ardent student of theology and philosophy, and during his lifetime he wrote many notable volumes which had a powerful influence upon English thinking during the late 17th and early 18th centuries. As a 7-year-old, anybody here at 7 years old? Geraldine? Abby? Boy, he's got his hand up. Evan's got his hand up, his head down. He's sleeping. 7 years old. Oh, is Kyle a 7-year old as well? 7 years old. Now, thinking about your child, those of you that had a child that's 7 years old, think that your child would write something like this? As a 7-year-old, he wrote an acrostic spelling out the letters of his name. Isaac Watts, I am a vile, polluted lump of earth. S. So I've continued ever since my birth. A. Although Jehovah grace doth daily give me. A. As sure this monster, Satan, will deceive me. C. Come therefore, Lord, from Satan's claws relieve me. Wow. W. Wash me in thy blood, O Christ, A. And grace divine impart. T. Then search and try the corners of my heart. T. That I in all things may be fit to do. S. Service to thee and thy praise too. I mean, I just can't fathom a 7-year-old writing something like that. While Watts was still in his teens, he became very dissatisfied with the deplorable psalm-singing characteristic of this time in the churches. The following was some of the typical doggerel, I don't know how you pronounce that, being sung. This is what they sang in the church that he attended. Ye monsters of the bubbling deep, your master's praises spout. Up from the sands ye docelings peep and wag your tails about. Aren't you glad we have some good songs to sing? You know, I've referred to Robert and Ruth singing up here. About every time they sing, they choose an old song. I'm glad they don't choose these old songs. You know, they choose good old songs. One Sunday, after returning from a service of this type of psalm singing and being deeply concerned and critical of congregational singing, young Isaac was challenged by his father with the words, "Well then, young man, why don't you give us something better to sing?" Watts, then 18 years of age, accepted his father's challenge. The next Sunday, he produced his first hymn, to which the congregational response was enthusiastic. For the next 2 years, young Watts wrote a new hymn text for his people every Sunday. He published a collection of 210 of these hymns in 1707 in a book entitled Hymns and Spiritual Songs. In all, Isaac Watts wrote approximately 600 hymns throughout his lifetime. He has rightly been called the father of English hymnody. Because of his bold departure from the traditional metrical psalms and the use of human composer hymns, expressions based entirely on one's own thoughts and words, Watts was generally considered to be a radical churchman in his day. But today, more than 2.5 centuries later, our hymnals still contain such Watts favorites as, "O God, our help in ages past," a paraphrase of Psalm 90. "Jesus shall reign," a setting of Psalm 72. "When I survey the wondrous cross, I sing the mighty power of God, and am I a soldier of the cross." Probably recognized all of those except for maybe one of them. It is interesting to make a brief comparison between Isaac Watts and George Frederick Handel, who is generally credited with being the source of this hymn's music. Watts was a frail, 5-foot-tall, rather homely but gentle-mannered figure, while Handel was known as the robust, hot-tempered, cosmopolitan German master of the keyboard, opera, and oratorio. Both men lived in London during this time and evidently knew each other. The story of Handel's greatest contribution to sacred music was what? The Messiah. The oratorio, The Messiah, is generally familiar to most people. In 1741, Handel began writing the music for this biblical text, and in the course of just 24 days, completed all 53 numbers. The Messiah was given its first official public performance on April 13, 1742. It is undoubtedly the most frequently performed oratorio ever written, as well as the most highly esteemed. And then in 1836, Lowell Mason, an American choir director, composer, and public school educator, is thought to have rearranged a portion of Handel's Messiah, likely from some of the phrases in the numbers, "Comfort ye and lift up your heads," to fit the words of Watts' joy to the world. This adapted tune became known as the Antioch tune and first appeared in Lowell Mason's Modern Psalmist in 1839. Though various other tunes have been used on occasion with Isaac Watts' text, Antioch has proven to be the most popular and lasting. Lowell Mason is also the composer of the music for the hymns, A Charge to Keep I Have, My Faith Looks Up to Thee, O Day of Rest and Gladness, don't know that I know that one, From Greenland's Icy Mountains, Near My God to Thee, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Through the combined talents of a frail English literary genius of the 18th century, a German-born musical giant from the same period, and a 19th century American choir director and educator, another great hymn was born that has since found a permanent place in the pages of our American church hymnals for use during every Advent season. Joy to the World. We haven't sung that one this evening. Let's get our songbooks out and turn to that one. 447. And while we sing this one, let's stand together. And when we're done, we'll dismiss in prayer and go home.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare Him room. Heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and heaven and nature sing. Joy to the world. Men their songs employ, while fields and floods, rocks, hills, and plains repeat the sounding joy. Repeat the sounding joy. Repeat, repeat the sounding joy. No more let sin and sorrows grow.
Tonight. Bless you this week. Give you a good week in Him. Jason, would you dismiss us in prayer?